Heavenly Father, thank you for this good day. Thank you that you are present with us. Teach us things that we need to know and help us to serve you better. In Jesus' name, amen. So, today we're talking about the first big missions conference within the Protestant church as a whole. So people from all different denominations were present at this. Most all of them were from England and the United States, but it had happened. So I want to back up and ask the question about their basis for what they're going to do here, and asking the question, what is a missionary? Now, that seems like a basic question to us today, but as you know, the word missionary is not in the Bible, just like Trinity. So people don't understand it all the same way. I think this is kind of a simple definition that could apply to anybody, no matter whether they're a Christian or not, someone sent on a mission. So do you suppose that King Saul was a missionary? He said, I've obeyed the voice of the Lord. I've gone on the mission which the Lord sent me. Does that make Saul a missionary? Most people wouldn't call Saul a missionary, but, you know, strictly by a definition, it seems like it fits. In the Bible, we have other words used for people who we would call missionaries. One is apostle, that's someone sent, and also sometimes evangelist. And these are four passages in the Bible. Well, the first one's not a passage, but there's lots of descriptions of the apostles where we can see a missionary idea being expressed in the life of somebody. In addition to those cases, there's also a list of people who commentators often call missionaries because of what they did and who they were associated with. Obviously, Silas went with Paul, things like that. So, even though we don't have the word missionary used in the Bible, we can say the concept is clearly there, just like it is for Trinity. So another question is, did the Great Commission apply only to the 12 apostles, or does it apply to everybody else? Anybody have a thought about that? These are two passages where we read about the idea of missionary. Jesus said, as the Father has sent me, so I am sending you. But who is he talking to? I think he's talking to his disciples. Same way with Acts 1, just before he ascends to heaven. So some people look at this and say, he's talking to the apostles, not talking to us. How do we make that transition? Anybody have some thoughts about that?
Well, in the Great Commission, he was talking to more than just the 12 apostles.
I'm sorry, say it again?
In the Great Commission, he was talking to more than just the 12 apostles.
Well, how do you know that? That's who he's talking to right there, isn't he? I don't know. I think that's an assumption we make. But there are some people that argue that, strictly speaking, it's not talking to us. We've all interpreted it that way.
Why? To what point do they make that argument? Hey, it was only to the apostles, so... You don't understand my question?
Are you
saying... You're saying some would argue that it was only to the apostles. Why would they argue that?
Because that's who he's talking to when he says that. That's all.
So, okay.
But generalizations, I mean, words to the apostles are for all of us too, because it was recorded in Scripture.
Well, I don't know if that's quite true. I mean, you know, some things in the Bible certainly are not talking to me.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to argue against missions, but I'm just trying to say sometimes we have to be careful about how we interpret what it says. But
I mean, here's a practical question, right? It says
what's that?
Go go into all the world and proclaim the gospel to the whole creation. I mean, practically, that would be very difficult for 12 to do.
But they kind of did that, though, according to tradition. And Thomas went to India, supposedly.
Well, but then those who they went to, is it just, okay, we're going to go to like the first set and then we're done? Like nobody else should go and repeat this.
So when the Roman Catholic Church says Jesus told Peter, you're a rock, I'm going to build my church, mm-hmm. and then you use papal succession mm-hmm. to use that, and we kind of say, wait a minute, the Pope, the people who succeeded Peter don't have the same authority that he did, because he was an apostle, mm-hmm. and they are, a lot of them did a lot of bad things. So I don't want to dwell on this too much, but just... Go ahead.
So Matthew 28:19-20. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. So if this is part of what is teaching, what Jesus is teaching his disciples and telling them to go make disciples and teach them all that he's commanded, then that
would carry
forward through this age.
Okay. I think that's how most of us look at that verse, but I just want to point out, not everybody does.
Okay.
But here's somebody who did. Dick Hillis grew up in Monroe, not very far from here. When he was a young boy, he got into lots of trouble. In fact, when he was about 17, he decided to run away from home because he didn't like his father's emphasis on going to church and all this kind of stuff. So he was working for a store. They trusted him. They gave him a key. He went in one night and stole a bunch of money and took a bus and went all the way to California. He couldn't find work down there, and they decided, like the prodigal son, to go back home. His parents received him. He paid off his debt. And then he didn't know what to do. But his twin brother had enrolled in what was then called the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. So he decided to go down there. And they let him in, even though he couldn't write his Christian testimony very well, but he didn't know what else to do. And it was there that his life kind of changed. And he ended up being the youngest missionary ever to go with China Inland Mission, which was started by Hudson Taylor. He went when he was 20 years old to China. And this was back in the 30s. And after he'd been there a year, he heard about the death of... John and Betty Stamm. They were executed by the Chinese. I think they were beheaded. And he got a little anxious about that. And he came back to the United States and then later went, after World War II, to Taiwan. There was an appeal made by Madame Chiang Kai-shek to come evangelize the army there. And he went and did that and started a mission. And that later became another mission, which when I was young was called Orient Crusades, which was all over Southeast Asia. And today is, what's it called? It's called one, I forget what it's called, something else. But they kept changing the name for very fun. Anyway, he says here, every heart with Christ is a missionary. Every heart without Christ is a mission field. So that's his definition. But to counter that, and I got this off of the website of some Reformed website, I can't remember which one it was now, they said, when everyone's a missionary, no one really is. That's based on the idea, when everything's important, nothing's important. You've got to differentiate somehow. But I think that's kind of a weak argument against the fact that we are all called to be missionaries of one sort or another. It doesn't mean we've got to go to Timbuktu, but we have neighbors around us.
I think we also see echoes of these ideas in the Abrahamic covenant when Abraham is told that there would be a blessing for him and for all the families of the earth shall be blessed through him. So I think this is not just a concept that we're seeing here, but a concept that's been holding true throughout the history of Israel as well.
Yes. You're getting a little ahead of me, but that's I agree with you. That's good. So, when did missions begin? I'm saying it wasn't with the Great Commission. So, who was the first missionary? Now, some people think it might have been Jonah. Obviously, God sent Jonah to Nineveh, and he didn't want to go, but eventually he did go and made a big difference. But, as you just brought up, Abraham, even before he was Abraham, was told he would be a blessing. And he was sent to somewhere. He didn't know where he was going. Actually, you know, Abraham came from probably the most civilized part of the world when he was a young man. That was really was the case. And he gets over to Palestine, where it's like going to the Wild West when there was nobody around. And he did end up having this prophecy fulfilled through him, as we know. But what about Lot? Was he a missionary? He's called righteous here. What do you think? Just because you are unsuccessful at changing anyone, does that make you not a missionary? I don't think so. And what about Noah? Was he a missionary? Now, the trouble with people like this is some people think you've got to go somewhere to be a missionary. I think that's kind of a false idea. People come to you, just like today. People come to the U.S. from all over the world for an education. They're coming to us. And the mission organization called International Students is out to reach those kind of people. So, moving on from there, let's just talk a little bit about where we've been. There have been quite a few examples of mission work that we've read about and thought about, especially the Jesuits, but there were other things as well. I mean, the fall of Jerusalem, when people are scattered all over the place. In some ways, you could say God is sending them through the act of a political crisis, and they spread all over the world, at least the known world then. And Charlemagne certainly was somebody who wanted to see missions expanded and did something to help that financially. Among Protestants, though, things didn't get started quite so fast. I mean, you can think of the Reformation perhaps as a mission movement, but in fact, by today's standard, it was really just trying to reform the church, not really, bring about the conversion of the pagans, okay? So by that standard, by what the Catholic Church had been doing, the Protestant Reformation really didn't reach those kind of people hardly at all. The problem is Protestants were involved in arguing with Catholics about what's the way to interpret the Bible. They were arguing with themselves. You know, a lot of those major reformers couldn't get together on even how to understand the Lord's Supper or baptism. So all this kind of detail they were arguing about was keeping them from doing what I think would be, we'd all consider to be more important. Not that we would have done any better, but nevertheless, it was a hindrance to mission activity. But something that did happen that was sort of interesting, and that is because of persecution in various places, there were people who went somewhere else to escape the persecution, and that happened in Geneva, where Calvin was early on. People from England, Italy, Netherlands, and Scotland came to Geneva, and the population, it says here, just nearly doubled at that time. But from Geneva, things expanded, like John Knox was one who went back to Scotland. John Knox was maybe not the best example of a missionary because he would offend people unnecessarily. In fact, Calvin got mad at him because he was so hard-nosed about what he believed and what he did. But here's what Calvin wrote to Farrell, his good friend. "I am, meanwhile, much preoccupied with the foreigners who daily press through this place in great numbers, or who have come here to live, Should you pay us a visit next autumn, you will find our city considerably increased, a pleasing spectacle to me if they do not overwhelm me with their visits. So all these people are coming to Geneva to escape problems, and Calvin's helping to train them to go other places, to go back home, for example. And London itself became a refugee center when King Edward VI was king, because he was Protestant friendly, and so people came there. And one of these was a Polish pastor who became pastor to foreigners during this time. And then, of course, he had to leave when Mary became queen. From Geneva, we have missionaries being sent to the Netherlands. one guy here who went there, do I have his name here? Yes, his name is Pierre Brulé. 3 months after he got there, he was killed. He was martyred. Calvin sent people to France. Look at this change in the Protestant church in France in just a few years. In 7 years, the churches went from 5 to over 2,000. That's amazing to have that happen so fast. The Protestant movement in France before the persecution came was huge. And that from 200 missionaries. They're obviously starting more than one church, each one of them. He sent people to Brazil, Poland, Hungary, and other places. And missionaries went from Netherlands to India. We've talked about the Moravians before, but I think they need to be emphasized here again in terms of the Protestant missionary movement. First of all, note that Huss died quite a long time before Luther. He died in 1415. Luther's theses nailed to the church wall didn't happen until 1517, 100 years later. And as we know, there were a lot of people who were following Huss, and this map here shows Bohemia as it was at one point, I think around 1600, and as part of the Holy Roman Empire. And Bohemia had a king who was Protestant, so he protected these followers of Huss after Huss was killed. And they continued as a Protestant group for a long time, until 1617, when the king became Catholic. And when that happened, those people went underground, but they're still around. They didn't get eliminated the way things happened in France with the Huguenots. So this is what the headquarters of the Moravians looks like today. They finally were protected by Nicholas von Zinzendorf, and he protected them by inviting them to come to his estate, which was very big, and he set up a little community for them. And that community, I think, probably did more for Protestant missions than any community ever has in history, given how big it was. There were never more than 1,000 people here, but they sent out something like 300 missionaries. And, of course, as we talked about before, some of them were the ones that helped the Wesleys understand the gospel, because they were coming to North America as well. So before he died, his missionaries had gone all over the world. I mean, you could say, in terms of the Great Commission, they'd virtually gone everywhere. And of course, they didn't go to every square foot of land, but they went to people all over the place. They were the first Protestant missionaries to evangelize slaves. And of course, in the New World, their slaves were all over the place. They were the first Protestant missionaries in many other countries. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is now a city bigger than Issaquah, was a Moravian mission station. That's how it started. And they called it Bethlehem to link it to the scriptures. I want to also mention back here on this one slide here, that when the king became Catholic, he did reduce the population of the Moravians considerably. They went from about 3 million to 800,000, but that was compounded by the plague, which ravished Europe a lot in those days. This chart here is kind of interesting. This shows, it says notable missionaries from Martin Luther to the end of the 18th century, but notable is a matter of judgment, I suppose. But the green are all Catholics. The blue are all Protestants. And the yellow are Moravians. So the Moravians are kind of concentrated down there in one area, and that's about the same time as the movement to the American colonies took place with, and where they encountered the Wesleys. But they're a significant part of this whole thing, even though in numbers they're a very small community. That's what's so amazing about what they did. Any questions or comments about that? I want to mention three other individuals who went during this time as Protestants. One was a German Lutheran.
Dan?
Yeah.
Could you remind us of what Moravians believe or teach or whatever?
Moravians are people that came out of the pietistic end of the Lutherans. So remember, pietism was taking what seemed to be at the time for a lot of people sterile, cold Lutheran theology and making it personal. So it's not just what you believe, it's recognizing the new birth is important, recognizing personal Bible study is important, having small groups. They were evangelical in a way that a lot of the Lutheran churches had become rather just come to church like the Catholics did. We just don't believe in the Pope, you know, that kind of thing. That's a very simplistic look at it. But that we talked about that a few times ago. I can't actually remember which lesson it was on. But they were the Lutherans that really understood what it means to be spiritually alive. And, of course, they're now following the Great Commission the way we think it should be followed. The Lutheran Church as a whole wasn't doing so much, but those people really were. Any other questions or comments? By the way, stop me anytime, especially if I make a mistake, which some people hear me make a mistake and don't say anything, but it's important to do that because I don't want to misinform everybody.
So they are definitely considered Christians then?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Today, the Moravians, I think, have lost their way a bit. I mean, it's an old denomination. It's older than the rest of the ones we've got here. But in eastern Pennsylvania, where they are concentrated, and a few other places, I don't think they're quite as... They've lost a lot of what their fervor was before. What they do have is good music. They have concerts where not just choirs and accompaniment, but they have concerts of what they call lower brass. So trombones, baritones, and tubas, and they play beautiful music. It's really kind of amazing. This man, Peter Hayling, went first to Egypt and then Ethiopia. In Ethiopia, he translated the New Testament into Amharic, which was a big deal. In Ethiopia, kind of like the Catholic Church, which had Latin as its language in worship and also in the church, but by the time, time of the Reformation, certainly, people didn't know Latin except for the scholars in the church. So it was kind of it separated people from understanding what the Bible was saying. And the same is true in Ethiopia. Their old language was Ge'ez, and that's still around today, but only in the Orthodox Church. Ethiopians don't understand it. And this guy took and translated the New Testament into Amharic, which is the language that's spoken today in Ethiopia. So he was doing for Ethiopia what the Protestants did for the church in the West. No one's quite sure why he died, but he might have been martyred or something. But anyway, he didn't live to be an old man. But he went by himself, and nobody came after him. So there's no knowledge about how he got there, especially, but he felt God calling him, and he went. Here's another pietist who went to India. This guy was actually sent by the King of Denmark. The King of Denmark at that time, Frederick IV, was a very mission-minded king, and he helped missions in lots of different ways. And then we have another pietist named Kallenberg, who translated not just the Bible, but also theological works into Arabic, Persian, and Turkish, which are all unrelated. And that's in itself kind of an amazing thing to have done. A couple early organizations that were established for the purpose of sending missionaries were these two. The first one in England, the second one, it's a combination of, I'm not sure if it was located in what's now Czechoslovakia or not. Maybe the Danish funded it. I don't know the answer to that question. But this was the beginning of mission organizations. But as a whole, things didn't really go so well in the 18th century. Partly because of the Jesuits. We talked about them before, how they were basically shut down, even suppressed by the Pope. They were underground. They had become too political and too dogmatic for everyone's comfort. And so these countries just said, forget it. And that's toward the end of the 18th century. Not just there, but also in Russia. Peter the Great was not great for what he did for the church, but he replaced the patriarch with something called the Holy Synod, which was a collection of men who were part of the church and also some non-cleric people who he appointed to this committee to basically run things. And they became accountable to him. So basically he made the church something subservient to the state. Something similar to what had happened in other places, as you know. But the one who really did it in Russia was Catherine the Great. And she didn't start out to be queen. Her husband was king, but she helped a coup to get rid of him. So he was only in office about 6 months. And then she took over. She nationalized all church property. She closed all the monasteries. She took the money away from the clergy. So in other words, if you want to get your child baptized, you got to give a fee to the priest. If you want to have him perform a funeral, you got to give money to the priest. That's how he lived. There was no money being supported. Of course, we can say, well, maybe that's not quite so bad because state-supported churches aren't such a good idea anyway. But nevertheless, shutting things down that way without people having a sense of just sort of, you know, making a tithe or something like that was not difficult. Protestants couldn't build churches, but guess what? If you're a Muslim, you could have your mosque built. In fact, they would even support you in doing that. And why did they do that? They did that because they were trying to get these Muslims to assimilate into the Russian culture. And that didn't come off quite as successfully as probably she wanted. But nevertheless, she worked to try to bring Muslims into the culture. Now, you know, if you look at a map of Russia, right below Russia is a whole bunch of Asian countries, which are basically all Islamic. And so they're part of the Russian Empire at various times, to various degrees. She even bribed people to convert to Christianity, but it was this Christianity which wasn't working very well. She promised toleration, but she sent 20,000 Christians to Siberia in exile. So Catherine the Great really put a damper on whatever was going to happen in the Orthodox Church in Russia. Basically, she's doing what we read about after the Enlightenment. Christianity is eliminated from being a central part of culture to being marginalized. In other words, it's okay if you want to be a Christian, Just don't tell the world about it. Don't tell your neighbor about it. Keep it to yourself. And so that's the beginning of secularization in Russia. It wasn't the communists who started this. It was her. Any questions about that? And also during the 18th century, there was a lot of war in Europe. And that contributed to a lessening of missionary activity. But after 1800, things began to change. And during this century, the proportion of the world's people that would be called Christian increased from 25% to 35%, which is the most significant increase since the 4th century, according to what statistics we have. Now, of course, remember, whenever we're talking about this, we're talking about Christians in a nominal sense. These are people who are Christians, like we would say, but there's also people who just identify themselves as Christians, because we don't really know. As you know, Augustine came up with the idea of the invisible church, which means only God knows who are truly born again. It's not something we can count. We do, but it doesn't really tell us the truth. Nevertheless, it's a significant change that happened in the 19th century, and it's because of how missions took off. By the 1830s, most Protestant denominations were sending missionaries from these countries. And I'll just give you one little side personal note about this. My mother's family came from Denmark, and she did not hear the gospel clearly, even though they went to a Lutheran church in South Dakota. And she basically told me, in Denmark, there are no Christians left. Well, actually, that's not quite true. There are Christians in all kinds of places where you don't think they are. But when I was in Ethiopia, I went to a conference once of theological educators, and I met two men from Denmark who both were running Bible schools in Denmark to help educate people who want to become pastors. In order to become a pastor in the state church in Denmark, you've got to go to the university where your theological education is not sound. So these men set up Bible schools where you could get an evangelical understanding of the Bible. And so they told me that actually in Denmark, in the state church, if the church sends someone to become your pastor, the people can actually reject him if they want to. And since most of the people who go to state churches at all are people who care more about the gospel, in other words, a lot of people go to church only when they're baptized and when they're buried and when they're married. That's about it. But for people who are more devout and actually biblical, they could actually reform the whole state church in Denmark if they got together, I think. Anyway, during this time, there's also a rise in a lot of martyrdom. It happened for lots of different reasons, but part of the reasons are these: confusion over what it means to be a missionary. Because, as you know, a lot of missionaries didn't just take the gospel, they took their culture with them. So they wanted you to dress like they dress. And of course, you know, in Africa, a lot of people didn't dress hardly at all. So they decided that's not good. We need to have standards for behavior. We've got to get rid of polygamy and all these things. And sometimes the way they did that didn't lend itself too well with the people who understood it. And it was not easy to understand the differences. There's also the problem of slavery and imperialism, which got mixed up with the church. And missionaries often went with the traders and the people trying to take advantage of the economic opportunities to go to different places, whether it's spices or whatever they're trading and bringing back to Europe. And there's also problems over syncretism. When you try to accommodate the gospel to a different culture, you have to translate some ideas. I mean, for example, when the Bible talks about snow and you're in Africa, what does snow mean? Excuse me. You can't just talk about snow without some kind of explanation. And that's just a simple example. But there's lots of other ones where it was difficult for the missionary to understand who they were really talking to and how to explain the gospel to them. Some of these people who started out early on, which we think about today, I'll just mention a few of them. William Carey, who started out as a humble shoemaker in England, he became a pastor. He went to India and stayed there, and never came back home. He had a wife who most people today would say she had some kind of mental illness, and that was a heavy weight on him. They nevertheless had 7 kids, and he started something called the Baptist Missionary Society, and he did a lot of things to exemplify what it is for a missionary to go someplace, settle in and live, and stay there. And, you know, to go any place that's very different from wherever you're from and only stay for 1 or 2 years, you really can't accomplish much at all because you don't know what's going on. It takes a long time to understand another culture, and the roots are kind of deep. He translated the Bible, or portions of it, into all these languages, 6 languages. And this is somebody who didn't come from the upper class, didn't have a fancy education, but he did persevere. Hudson Taylor went to China. And he had an idea there which really made for success. And that is to become like a Chinaman. So he dressed like one. He didn't wear his Western clothes. And he helped make the church be a Chinese church, not a British church imposed upon them. This is a picture of over 60 women missionaries who'd gone to China, and they're all studying the language back in about 1931 or something like that. And that's part of the legacy of Hudson Taylor. Among Americans I want to mention, one is David Brainerd, who died when he was 29 years old from TB. He was actually sent away. He was in the middle of his education at Yale, and they kicked him out because he had TB. But he persevered, went to minister to Indian tribes in New York and Pennsylvania. And when Jonathan Edwards published his biography based on his journals, that had a big impact on lots of other people. It even had an impact on the founding of Dartmouth College and Princeton College, if you can imagine that, given what they are today. But that was how much of an impact his biography, which is still in print today, that Jonathan Edwards composed. Jonathan Edwards himself was given the pulpit of his grandfather in Northampton, Massachusetts, when he was a young man, his first church. His grandfather brought him in as an assistant and then keeled over soon after that, and Jonathan Edwards became the pastor there. But this church had departed somewhat from the ideals of Puritans and had come up with something called the Halfway Covenant, which meant that if you were baptized, you could get your children baptized in the church, even though you are not converted. Now, why would you want to do that? It's a good question. Unless you think baptism simply grants you a way into heaven and you don't have to worry about anything else. You couldn't vote in a church meeting. You couldn't take communion under church meeting. Being in that situation, and Jonathan Edwards refused to do that. He said, this is not what the gospel is about. And so for that, his church expelled him. Now, he could have gone anywhere at that time because he'd become known as somebody who was not just a powerful preacher, but someone whose intellect could not be challenged. He was part of the Great Awakening with George Whitefield. And instead of taking one of those nice jobs, he went out to be a missionary to the Housatonic Indians on the Connecticut frontier. And he came back to take over the presidency of Princeton at the time, but he wanted to show that it was a good idea to get yourself vaccinated against smallpox, and from that he died. And so he didn't live much beyond his time with the Housatonic Indians. Last one I want to mention is Adoniram Judson, who went out to India. Actually, there's an interesting story about him, too, and that is when he was a student at Williams College, he and some other students became interested in missions and helped start what's here listed as the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. This was a combination of Presbyterian, Congregational, and one other denomination. I don't know if I wrote down here. I guess I don't have it here. But he grew up, his father was a pastor, but early on in college he became a deist. He thought that made more sense. But then later on he got converted, and so he was part of a group of a few students who helped push the organization of this mission. But when he got to India, there was a conflict between what he wanted to do and what the economic interests wanted to do, like the the British East India Company. And so they made him leave, and he went to Burma. And Burma is a tough place to be even today, but he was there 6 years before one person was baptized. And after 12 years, only 18 believers. He was put in prison twice, but he translated the Bible into Burmese, and by the time he died, there were 100 churches in Burma. This is a list of Protestant mission organizations that got established in the 1800s, actually starting in 1795. There's a long list of them. So there's the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, which I mentioned just a minute ago. The other denomination that was part of that, besides Congregational and Presbyterian, were the Reformed Church in the United States. And here's more. There's also Roman Catholic orders that established in the 19th century, but not very many. Not very many new ones that were interested in missions at all, compared to previous times. So that was kind of surprising to me. They kind of stopped. Not to say that they didn't do anything, but these are very minor and you hardly hear about them. Russia had sort of an awakening after what happened before with Catherine the Great. And the Russian Orthodox Church sent people to the East, to China, to Japan, Korea, and they even came to Alaska, as this one guy mentioned here went. The Greek Orthodox Church didn't do much because of they were still under the Turks. So now I want to talk about the mission conference for just a few minutes before we quit. This missionary conference wasn't something that someone just thought, oh, this would be a good thing to do. It was a reaction to all that had been happening in the previous 100 years, all these missionaries and mission organizations being established. So this is now people saying, we need to have a bigger strategy for what we're going to do. And their focus was really on how do we evangelize the whole world. And they focused on a few different aspects of this. You know, when we first talked about the Holy Roman Empire, a lot of it was going just out to the areas right around them. And it took a while before they were going all over the world. Now, these are Protestants here, and they had not really experienced that same kind of thing that the Jesuits had done. But they're also recognizing we need to go to the whole world. And we need to focus on church planting. Church planting is an important aspect of what we're going to do. They asked about how we need to educate Christians about what's going on and how we explain the gospel to those who believe something else. How you talk to someone who's a Hindu, who's polytheistic, is different than how you talk to a Muslim who believes in one God. How you talk to a Buddhist. Those are all different, and it's not simple to do that without finding some common ground in their culture to bring that about. We're concerned with how we're going to train missionaries to do this. Again, not something that's obvious. They wanted to focus on organizing missions in these Western countries where the church was strong and helping them send people, and how to work with foreign governments that might not want someone to come in. Like, for example, today, places like India will not accept missionaries. That wasn't true way back then, but it's true today. So if you go to India as a missionary, you're not going to India as a missionary officially. You're going to something else. You can go and do lots of things, but you can't be a missionary. But, you know, in Pakistan, you can come as a missionary. That's a visa that's legal, just as long as you don't evangelize Muslims. Now, who else is there to evangelize? Well, there are Hindus in Pakistan, about as many Hindus as all Roman Catholics and Protestants put together. And they also wanted to promote Christian unity with the division of the church into many different Protestant sects. That's been a problem all along. Most of these people came from Britain or North America to this conference. And the leader of the whole thing was a man named John Mott, who incidentally got the Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, for his mission work. I wonder if that's ever going to happen again. He said, "It is possible for the most obscure person in a church with the heart right toward God to exercise as much power for the evangelization of the world as it is for those who stand in the most prominent positions." This is a reflection on lots of people who've gone who are nobodies, like the guy we just mentioned. Who was it?
Judson?
Huh?
Was it Judson?
Well, I was thinking of before that.
The shoemaker.
Yeah, the shoemaker. So, anyway, he also said, the history of missions is a history of prayer. Mott was a layman, but he was a leader in mobilizing mission work. So why is this a turning point? First of all, global Christianity became a conscious vision for the church. It's not that nobody thought about this before, but this became sort of an important aspect of what we're doing. We have got to reach the world with the gospel. You can think about Wycliffe Bible Translators. A while back they had a motto, 2,000 tongues to go. Well, since that time, they've discovered there's more than 2,000 languages in the world. It's now like about 7,000. But they still are working on that strategy to get the gospel translated, the Bible translated, into all these different languages, which I think is... it's going to happen soon, because they're doing different ways. They're using local or national people to help the translation. In fact, we met, Judy had a patient in Pakistan who was about to have, no, they had a baby, didn't they? Is that the cleft kid?
Yes.
Yeah, so this baby had a cleft problem, and they were kind of wandering around figuring out what to do, and Judy helped connect with a plastic surgeon who repaired it. And Judy actually, when she saw the kid before earlier, did not think he was going to live and was pretty sure he had died. But he didn't. He thrived and he survived. But anyway, this kid's father, a Muslim, was helping working on Bible translation in his local language, which was not Urdu or something else. So right there, they're using somebody to do the work who isn't even a Christian. Of course, there are people checking what's going on to make sure that it gets done correctly. And finally, this led to the ecumenical movement, which for most of us isn't really a good term, because that's associated with the World Council of Churches. But back then, the World Council of Churches had in it a lot of denominations which weren't so unsound as they've become today. So today, the World Council of Churches is not really such a good organization from a conservative theological standpoint. But nevertheless, it did bring people together, and it did point out something that we all need to recognize, and that is, if we're following Christ, we can't separate ourselves from other people who are basically doing the same thing. In other words, on the essentials, we all agree, and that should bring us together. We shouldn't separate on non-essentials. Any questions or comments? Yes?
Dan, where was John Mott? Did he have a certain mission field where he went?
He was not a missionary per se as far as going somewhere. He was like at home organizing things.
Okay. So when he won the Peace Prize, was it because of his organizational skills?
I think so. I don't know exactly. I never read what the citation says, but yeah. It was just kind of, when I saw that, whoa.
Yeah.
Yes, Mark.
You described a couple of missionaries as particular Baptists. Are those what we call Reformed Baptists now?
Yeah, that word's changed. There were free will Baptists who were like Arminian, and particular Baptists who were Calvinist. So, yeah. And they don't use that word today. They call them Reformed Baptists. But so they're Baptists, so they believe in only an adult baptism, but they understand a Reformed theology in other ways. But, yeah. Anybody else? Comment or question? Okay. Thank you. See you next week.